علیہ السلام. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
We find that they knew every messenger that left this world with As-Salah, As-Salah, Allahu Akbar. Salah, it's a pillar, very important. Tell me, where in the Quran does Allah mention that Fajr is 2, Dhuhr is 4, Asr is 4, Maghrib is 3, and Isha is 4? Where does it mention? Isn't Hajj another pillar? Huh? Where does Allah mention how many times to go around the Kaaba? There is no ayah in the Quran that tells us how many times to go around the Kaaba. There is no ayah. There is no ayah in the Quran that tells us how many cycles in each prayer. Yet it is the pillar of Islam. Why? Because Allah in the Quran is saying, these things you will get it from Rasulullah. Your messenger is the one who's going to show you which one it is, what it is. Therefore, the wali, the khalifa, the successor, it can be told by nobody but Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
Decades of segregation and economic inequality in the U.S. shoehorned many people of color, especially black Americans, into living in neighborhoods that are more vulnerable to climate change, says Jessica Corbett, writer, in an article titled, Study Finds U.S. Redlined Areas Face Greater Flood Risk from Climate Crisis. Stay tuned for more. Amid inadequate plans to reduce planet-heating emissions and climate scientists' repeated warnings about rising seas and more devastating extreme weather, Redfin revealed recently that formerly redlined areas across the United States face a higher flood risk than regions that weren't deemed undesirable for mortgage lending under the racist practice. The real estate brokerage analyzed flood risk in 38 major U.S. metropolitan areas for a new report entitled A Racist Past, A Flooded Future. Formerly redlined areas have $107 billion worth of homes facing high flood risk, 25% more than non-redlined areas. In 1930s, the federally sponsored Homeowners Loan Corporation developed mortgage security maps that ranked communities with grades and colors, from A, the best for lenders, in green, to B, still desirable, in blue, to C, definitely declining, in yellow, to D, zones declared hazardous, in red. While racial segregation of neighborhoods predated redlining, the lowest-ranked areas generally had more black families, while white households dominated regions with higher ratings. Though the Fair Housing Act of 1968 legally banned racial discrimination in housing, many neighborhoods once marked hazardous are still home to many people of color and low-income families. According to Redfin, 58.1% of households in redlined neighborhoods are non-white, compared with 40.4% of households in neighborhoods once declared desirable for lending. Decades of segregation and economic inequality shoehorned many people of color, especially Black Americans, into living in neighborhoods that are more vulnerable to climate change, said Redfin senior economist Shariar Bukhari. Redlining kept home values in Black neighborhoods depressed, which in turn meant there was less money invested and reinvested in those neighborhoods for decades to come. The cycle continues today, Bukhari said. As climate change fuels rising sea levels and powerful storms, many of these neighborhoods lack the funding for the infrastructure upgrades necessary to combat flooding. When major storms hit, Black communities are often forced to spend years rebuilding their homes instead of moving on and building home equity, the economist continued. This perpetuates a cycle in which Black families lack financially. From Hurricane Katrina in 2005 to Hurricane Harvey in 2017, communities of color and poor residents were disproportionately affected long-term. Last year saw a record-breaking Atlantic hurricane season, and experts warned that human-caused climate change is expected to exacerbate the impact of future storms. Severe storms and hurricanes have a disproportionate effect on minorities in terms of damage done, life lost, and the amount of money that gets reimbursed, Bukhari told Bloomberg. He added, this project was done to look back at the legacy of redlining and link it to the outcomes we see today. As Redfin found, nationally redlined and yellow-lined neighborhoods have a larger share of homes with high flood risk than green-lined and blue-lined neighborhoods, but only by a small margin, that is about 8.4% versus 6.9%. The discrepancy is much larger in a handful of U.S. metros, including Sacramento, New York, Boston, and Chicago. In Sacramento, 21.6% of homes, that is about $2.6 billion worth, in redlined and yellow-lined areas face high risk of flooding today. That compares with 11.8% of homes, that is about $716.8 million worth, in green-lined and blue-lined neighborhoods. That 9.8 percentage point difference represents the biggest gap of any metro in this analysis that had a large share of homes at risk in red-lined and yellow-lined neighborhoods. Nearly half of the households in Sacramento's red-lined and yellow-lined areas are occupied by people of color, compared with a third of households in green-lined and blue-lined areas. Behind the California capital is New York, where 13.8% of homes in red-lined and yellow-lined neighborhoods are at high risk of flooding, compared with 7.1% of homes in green-lined and blue-lined neighborhoods. The next two metro areas with the greatest gaps were Boston, 13.8% to 8.7%, then Chicago, 12.6% to 7.9%. The discrimination that happened in the past may seem like it happened a long time ago, but it compounds. Redfin chief economist Daryl Fairweather told CNN Business, it's not like the historical practices that were discriminatory diminished in effect. It seems like they actually increase in effect. Noting that over 600,000 properties face a 100-year flood risk, which is risk of one of these really catastrophic floods hitting them, Fairweather warned that future flood damage could worsen the U.S. racial wealth gap. In the face of rising seas and expected storm damage, Redfin and others have recommended federal investment in weather-proofing homes and relocation assistance. Fair Weather said that when we do provide assistance for people to move, we should encourage them or insist they move into places that won't be as affected by climate change. Research published in 2019 suggested that banks are already shifting mortgages made riskier by the climate crisis to financial institutions backed by U.S. taxpayers. Findings that, as New York Times put it, echo the subprime lending crisis of 2008, when unexpected drops in home values cascaded through the economy and triggered recession. With lenders looking at long-term risks and some U.S. communities from the coast to heartland already dealing with floods, President Biden is under pressure from climate experts and campaigners who backed his campaign to deliver on his promise to implement bold policies advancing environmental justice.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وبه نستعين إنه خير ناصر ومعين. The month is the month of Sha'ban, the month of Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. The occasions in which we do have some relevance to our imams, such as the birthday of imams or martyrdoms of imams, we should have some good benefits of these occasions in seeking proximity to God and performing our responsibility and duties toward these imams. And the one who is aware of his own personality and his relationship to his own imam can take benefit more of these occasions. Then let us focus on ourselves, focus on the day and night that we are in, and seek God's forgiveness, mercy, and blessings through our imams, especially Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam. Talking about the personality of Imam Al-Husayn is not so easy for me because Imam is such a notion, we cannot talk about the depth of this personality. But to the extent of our own understanding, we can talk a little bit about his characteristics and nobility and take our own benefit to the extent of our own perception of this imam. Just one point I want to focus on, and then to go next to that point and come to an end. Inshallah, at the end, good conclusion I want to mention. Imam had many, many characteristics, and you all know about most of them. I don't want to talk about these things. Just one issue is very important for me in the life of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, and that is his generosity. He was very well known as to be the most generous person in his lifetime, among the companions, among the people who lived with him within Medina at that time. Allah the Almighty says, if you want to practice generosity, you have to spend for the sake of God your property, your money, your honor, your family, when you love something. So from something that you love, you have to pay, you have to spend for the sake of God. It is not important to, give something for the sake of God, that is second-hand things or used things that you have, or you don't need them. So these are good, but not the highest level of generosity that you can achieve. لَن تَنَالُوا الْبِرَّ حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ. You cannot attain righteousness, goodness, except to spend for the sake of God from what you love it. You love your body, you love your own self, you have to pay it for the sake of God. You love your family, for the sake of God, you have to forgive the family that you're, receiving some badness from them. You have to omit their bad actions and themselves even, for the sake of God. You love your money, properties, your house, your car. You have to forget about all of them for the sake of God. Otherwise, you cannot reach righteousness. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam teaching us the way of being a generous person. So the generosity in both sides should be governed by some criteria. And this criteria is established by Imam al-Hussein himself. Two sides of generosity. The one who is in need offers his needs to a person. So this is one side. And the other side is the person who is generous, wants to satisfy the needs of a person who is in need. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. About the person who is in need and he is wanting to offer his needs to person. Imam says, be very careful. First, try not to offer your needs to any person. This is at the beginning. Because asking people for something is against your own dignity, your own honor. You have to violate your dignity, your honor to ask something. To be immune of, your dignity to be violated, first try to ask Allah the Almighty whatever you need. Because Allah has given many, many things for the people other than you, then He is able to do that for the sake of you. So why we're not asking God before going to the doors of people? Allah the Almighty is the best person. You can go to the door of Him and ask your needs. If you ask Allah the Almighty, so there are some people say, okay, we went to the door of Allah and we wouldn't receive anything. Don't be disappointed in this way. maybe Allah doesn't want to give you something. This is harmful for you. Maybe it is not good for you to receive something from God in this regard. Then you have to ask Allah the Almighty, but the result is not in your hands. If it's good for you, then Allah guarantees that. If it's not good for you, then Allah, you know, rejects your answer, your request. If you ask Allah and then you want to ask another people also, you know, most of people, especially ordinary people, practice some kind of, you know, polytheism. They always think about some partners next to God. You have to purify your intention toward God. Do not associate any partner next to God. Okay, there are some lay people cannot understand the depth of Tawheed or polytheism. They say, okay, there are some people are rich. There are some people capable enough to satisfy my need, then it's better for me to go to the door of that people.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Imam al-Hussein is the most generous Imam, and we can ask our needs. We can talk about our difficulties today, and inshallah he will give us much more than our needs. Oh Allah, for the sake of this Imam, please forgive our sins. And please put us among real Shia of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and among the helpers of Imam al-Mahdi. Ajalallah ta'ala farajaku al-Sharif. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Prosperous is he,
prosperous is he,
who spends his wealth on the poor and needy, who speaks a kind word to kin and neighbor, ever grateful for Allah's favor. Guided is he,
guided is he,
who prays Salah with punctuality. Early morning tahajjud he prays, for Allah's pleasure and nearness he craves. Blessed is he,
blessed is he,
who sings Allah's praises fervently. Blessed be all of Allah's slaves. Allah's mercy be with them always. Fortunate is he,
fortunate is he,
who remembers Allah abundantly. Worldly distractions cannot mildly sway his thoughts of Allah and Judgment Day.
COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. Even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fast approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of Zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead. New figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims, due to Islamophobia, they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired, they are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time, and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians, are actually contributing to ever-increasing environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
A group of 17 countries have united in defense of the United Nations Charter. The group seeks to form a coalition to promote multilateralism and counter the use or the threat of force and sanctions against other UN member states. The coalition, known as the Group of Friends in Defense of the Charter of the United Nations, includes Iran, China, Russia, Palestine, Syria, Venezuela, North Korea, and Cuba, as well as several other countries. The group has called for dialogue, tolerance, and solidarity, and that these are the core of international relations and vital for the peaceful coexistence among nations. The group's concept notes said unprecedented attacks against multilateralism have put the global peace and security in jeopardy, adding that imposition of coercive measures and the withdrawal from global agreements were signs of growing unilateralism. That is while all 17 members of the group were under sanctions during the former U.S. President Donald Trump's time in office. For instance, the Trump administration imposed sanctions against Iran over its peaceful nuclear program, China over alleged technology theft, and Russia over the 2014 integration of Crimea. Under Trump, Washington announced plans to quit the World Health Organization, pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council, the UN cultural agency UNESCO, the Paris Climate Change Accord, and the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, has pledged to reverse Washington's previous course as he rescinded the withdrawal from the World Health Organization and returned the U.S. to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. However, Biden has maintained the sanctions already in place against Iran, as well as against Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Syria, and other countries involved in the 17-party group of friends, proving that Washington has no plans to put an end to its hostile and illegal sanctions.
I think it's a very significant move. The United States announced after President Biden's inauguration that we were back on the world scene. And I think expected that everybody would make a sigh of relief and everything would be fine. But I don't think that's quite what's happened here. The Chinese and the Russians and, 17 other nations or more have signed this declaration to work through the United Nations to end the kind of unilateralism, unilateral interference in foreign affairs. Clearly, that's aimed at the United States.
Members of the Group of Friends coalition have railed against Washington's sanctions and intervention in various statements. A good example of Washington's unilateralism is its withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal unilaterally and rescinded hundreds of sanctions against Tehran. Since the U.N. Security Council Resolution 1737 was passed in 2006, the U.S. and the European Union have been the biggest supporters of sanctions against Iran in order to hamper its peaceful nuclear program. They have both passed numerous bills to impose ever harsher sanctions, including Washington's failed maximum pressure campaign. Last month, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the U.S. sanctions against Iran have inflicted the country's economy with $1 trillion worth of damage. China has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop its illegal unilateral sanctions on Iran. Meanwhile, Russia has slammed the anti-Iran sanctions by Washington, calling them anti-human. However, despite being a failed policy, Washington continues its futile approach. According to the report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period.
After all, if we talk about the Middle East, it was the United States who withdrew from the nuclear accords. That's an act of hostility. And then to blame the Iranians and say, unless they do something, we're not going to come back. I mean, this is the kind of double standard we face. And it is one that's going to have to be overcome politically in this country before there's going to be a change.
A recent report by the Washington Post revealed that the U.S. has attempted to change other nations' governments 72 times between the years 1947 and 1989 during the Cold War. Finally, when the U.S. continues to apply sanctions for its own political gains and gets away with it, or when the Israeli regime breaks the most U.N. resolutions, essentially making the resolutions ineffective, doesn't that put the U.N. institution's purpose under question?
The United States set to build a new nuclear missile dubbed Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, GBSD, under a program for modernizing its nuclear stockpile. The $100 billion missile is expected to replace nuclear missiles, which have been operational since the 1960s. The new nuclear weapon under development would be able to travel nearly 10,000 kilometers, carrying a warhead more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The U.S. Air Force is reportedly planning to order 600 of them. According to the U.S. Congressional Budget Office report, over the next decade, Washington will spend some $500 billion on its nuclear forces, which will translate into a whopping $1.5 to $2 trillion expenditure over the next 30 years.
There's no clear reason as to why the U.S. needs this hugely expensive modernization program, except that it has a lot of support in Congress, and the military-industrial complex always wants it, and The U.S. Military machine is kind of a self-propelling mechanism. It just keeps, going on, getting bigger and bigger and spending more money, no one seems to know how to control it, even if they really want to control it.
Washington began its nuclear weapons modernization program under former U.S. President Barack Obama. His successor, former President Donald Trump, who made every effort to reverse Obama's legacy, embraced his stance on nuclear weapons. Trump doubled the number of America's low-yield nuclear weapons. In February 2020, the Pentagon said a new low-yield warhead was deployed on the USS Tennessee submarine patrolling in the Atlantic Ocean to deter, quote, potential adversaries like Russia. The United States withdrew from the Cold War era Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in April 2019, accusing Russia of violating the deal, something that Kremlin has denied. The INF Treaty, reached with the Soviet Union in 1987, banned land-based missiles with a range of between 500 to 5,500 kilometers. With the treaty out of the way, the U.S. tested new missiles and made plans to renew its nuclear weapons tests. The U.S. shares the unaccountability with its closest allies, including Saudi Arabia and Israel, whose nuclear programs have been repeatedly slammed as non-transparent. Israel, the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, has tightly withheld information about its nuclear weapons program. It's estimated to be keeping some 100 nuclear warheads in its arsenal. Turning a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, the regime has so far refused, with the U.S. invariable support, to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, that is aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia, which is a member of the NPT, has so far declined requests from International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect its nuclear sites. Despite this, the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, said in September last year that he believed Riyadh is after a peaceful nuclear program. But the approach toward other countries, including Iran, has been different. The U.S. withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal with Tehran, dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, despite the IAEA's several reports from inspections that showed that Iran had been in full compliance with the international accord.
The whole bargain that was the basis for the nuclear non-proliferation treaty was that the existing nuclear powers would wind down their nuclear arsenals in return for other countries not creating nuclear weapons of their own. And so the U.S. Has adhered to neither of those principles. Both legs of that policy are being violated constantly. And U.S. Nuclear policy is in disarray, just as U.S. foreign policy in general is in disarray.
U.S. President Joe Biden is yet to take measures that would show his administration is willing to put an end to the double standard that is threatening the security of not only the region, but the whole world.
The United States' close ties with some of the regimes in West Asia, especially its support for oil-rich Persian Gulf Arab rulers, have long been blamed for many of the problems in this part of the world. A case in point is Saudi Arabia, which is controlled by an autocratic regime with a notorious human rights record. It never gets even a slap on the wrist for its violations of human rights inside the kingdom and its destabilizing actions in the region. Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war gets little attention on Western news channels and no criticism from the White House. Later this month, it will be the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led offensive against its southern neighbor. The U.S. is definitely a partner in this aggression. For most of the war, the U.S. military provided support, including intelligence and logistics for the Saudis and their Emirati allies. In response to the ongoing Saudi-led bombardment, the Yemenis have been learning to hit back with missile strikes and drone operations. And this is definitely angering the Saudis and their supporters, who have loudly condemned Yemeni retaliatory attacks. Such stances, especially by the United States, States have drawn fierce criticism. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed the U.S. for distorting the truth about what is happening in the region. The Ansarullah's capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision are improving fast. Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution slammed the U.S. and the United Nations on Thursday for condemning the Yemenis whenever they managed to retaliate against Saudi Arabia. The Iranian leader says the U.N. is even acting worse than the U.S., as the world body has failed to criticize Saudi Arabia for pounding Yemen for 6 years. Ayatollah Khamenei also had tough words for the U.S. for failing to act on the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The leader said Washington is turning a blind eye to the gruesome assassination and keeps up its support for the Saudi regime and still claims to be a supporter of human rights. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is widely under fire for deciding not to punish the Saudi leadership despite the recent release of an intelligence report that shows Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the 2018 assassination. The Biden administration has concluded that directly penalizing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would risk damaging American interests. Before taking office, Biden had promised to take a very tough line on the kingdom over its human rights violations. But so far, Biden seems to have done too little to keep that promise.
Virtually nowhere has Biden done anything to change his policies. I don't think that's going to happen. The fact is that American policy making happens in the corridors of power behind the scenes, and the presidents essentially, whether they're Democrat or Republican, do as they're told. They do as the money mafia in the background tell them, or the system, the systemic, if you like, backdrop which is there. And Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of pointed to this, that the system, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's the World Bank, whether it's the American government, whether it's, whether it's even the likes of WHO, there is an international network of, if you like, levers of power, which are used to make sure that all and sundry follow exactly what they're told to do.
Welcome to The Light. Let's go to the U.S. where a baby giraffe has explored his habitat at the Indianapolis Zoo for the first time. In a sunny day, Candy playfully made his first public appearance along with his mother and the herd. The cute calf was born in November and has no siblings yet. Giraffes are native to sub-Saharan Africa, so the zookeepers only allow them to be outside when the weather is not wet or cold. Two tiny islands in South Korea have become tourist attractions by turning almost everything to purple. They are now known as Purple Islands. Banwol and Bakji Islands used to be abandoned locations with small populations of elderly people. But everything changed when residents launched a popular campaign there in 2015. Inspired by their native balloon flower, they started painting the houses, roads and bridges in different shades of purple. They planted more purple flowers on the islands and wore clothes with the same color. Restaurants on the islands also started serving purple food.
We couldn't travel overseas due to COVID-19, so we thought about a local trip instead and found these purple islands. It's amazing and looks like fairy tales and magic. As I'm seeing, the grandmas are all wearing purple clothes. It is very dreamy.
The tourists also praise the welcoming spirit of the islanders who offer a free entry to the visitors dressed in purple. The campaign has changed the island's ambience, adding liveliness and activity to the routine of its residents. It's also attracted the government support, which has invested more than $4 million to turn the islands purple. world-renowned musician Yo-Yo Ma has transferred a COVID-19 vaccine waiting room to a concert hall in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh. Played the pieces after receiving a second dose of the coronavirus jab. Dozens of socially distanced people who had just received their second shot listened on at the Berkshire Community College while waiting for the 15-minute mandatory observation period to end. Yo-Yo Ma, who is a local resident, has said his performance was meant to give something back to the community.
Russians in the town of Yaryapolsky mark the end of winter with a colorful Maslenitsa celebration. People dressed in costumes march in the center of the town, which lies some 170 kilometers from Moscow. After some friendly competitions, participants burn the effigy of Maslenitsa. This marks the end of winter and was believed to fertilize the soil and bring a good harvest in the upcoming autumn.
The Maslenitsa went great. We have been sitting at home for a long time because of this COVID, but now everything is fine.
Maslenitsa is celebrated during the last week before the Christian festival of Lent. It is a last chance to the upcoming weeks to eat dairies and meat which are forbidden in the upcoming fasting time. The festival began as a pagan ritual, but was later absorbed into the Russian Orthodox Christian tradition.
Now, plastic waste has become a global environmental challenge, causing frustration amongst residents as recycling isn't common everywhere. But a Filipino artist has grabbed the opportunity to turn trash into treasure. Since 2019, Gilbert has been transforming plastic waste, especially non-recyclable trash, into beautiful paintings. He has so far made over 24 artworks by scattering shredded plastic bits across his canvases. The artist also uses expired paint and leftover wood from demolished homes. Gilbert gets some of those materials from around his neighborhoods, while the rest is given to him by donators. He says he got the idea to put that waste to good use when he found out his country is one of the world's top plastic waste producers.
We are the third contributor of plastic waste into the ocean, the third in the world. When I found out about that, I had to think of ways to raise awareness and knowledge on the reasons why we contribute this much waste.
The artist's works have been displayed in famous galleries in the Philippines. They have sold for prices ranging from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars. Gilbert has also created an advocacy group called Green Arts, aimed at encouraging artists to use recycled waste for their work.
Now, the first gorilla born in the Berlin Zoo in 16 years finally has a name. The naming day was celebrated with no visitors due to the coronavirus pandemic. However, zookeepers made the day special for the tiny Tila and her first-time mother with their favorite treats. The baby was born in mid-February. After a few weeks, the zoo received over 17,000 name suggestions for her. The low number of female firefighters across the world may indicate women's lack of interest in the job, but this female-only Brazilian firefighter crew is here to prove the opposite. The all-female team say their main goal is to empower women through the work they do. They say they are willing to prove that women can take any job that can help society. The firefighting crew started their activity just on Monday on International Women's Day. They work in southeastern Brazilian states. Although women have a variety of fire service roles in different countries, they account for less than 20% of firefighters worldwide.
In China's commercial hub, Shanghai, is not only filled up with skyscrapers, but this cosmopolitan city has many incredible things to attract domestic and foreign tourists as well. Unofficial statistics show Shanghai is China's de facto capital of animal cafes, which are growing in terms of numbers and the variety of species that they host. There are now all kinds of animal coffee shops there. One of these venues is filled with cute furry raccoons, which sometimes tug at customers' clothes while they are served their food. In another cafe, clients can enjoy the company of outlandish reptiles as they sip hot drinks. Those who frequent these bistros say the activity helps them relax and forget the hustle and bustle of city life. An advert showcasing a bowling alley has become an instant hit online. By combining expert drone flying techniques and impressive filmmaking skills, the 90-second-long one-take video is titled Right Up Our Alley. The journey begins with a drone flying over the Grind Lake Bowl in the U.S. city of Minneapolis before swooping inside the venue at a remarkable speed. The device then flies over bowling lanes and small passageways, taking the audience on a tour of the entire facility. The footage ends by the drone crashing into the bowling pegs. The video has already racked up millions of views online.
Yeah, I think there's some skepticism there of it being a true one take. It is a true one take. There's no CGI. You know, that was kind of interesting, but also the positive nature of it, of people seeing the skill that it takes and the unique ability to, like, combine the skill of an amazing pilot, the technology of the drone, and the story that, thank you, the story that actually can be told through a one take.
The footage was shot by a quadcopter drone. It took the pilot and the director about 10 to 12 attempts over 2 hours to produce the perfect take. The filmmakers undertook the project free of charge. Their aim was to help local businesses recover from the coronavirus-related losses.
A Swedish scuba diver is using his skills to clean up the underwater environment.
My name is Fredrik Johansson, and 2 years ago I started up a project called Rena Malaren. We have two goals. One is to get a lot of toxic waste up from the water, and the other thing is to make people aware of this planet and to do better.
A number of Swedish scuba divers have voluntarily joined Johansson's program. They pull out harmful waste and trash from waterways and lakes. Johansson says he is shocked by the number of polluting fragments discovered in the Swedish marine environment. He says one of the main polluting factors is lead batteries discarded from boats. He says many waterways in the capital Stockholm are littered with these used batteries.
A new study has revealed a sad fact. Humans have destroyed around two-thirds of the world's tropical rainforests. According to a report by Rainforest Foundation Norway, logging and land conversion has ruined 34% of tropical rainforests. They have also caused degradation of another 30%, which makes the forest more vulnerable to fire and destruction. The report says that since 2002, over half of the vanishing has occurred in South America's Amazon. Experts believe the loss of tropical forests makes climate change worse. Japan is famous for its vending machines, but the technology is now being used to improve public access to coronavirus test kits. A group of medical experts in a clinic has set up 7 vending machines across the capital, Tokyo, to sell their test kits. Customers take the PCR test and then mail off their saliva sample for processing. Each machine holds 60 kits. The idea was met with great enthusiasm from people. It helps them to avoid crowded clinics.
Without PCR tests, we can't make a diagnosis. Early diagnosis and early treatment is a basic idea for all diseases. But unfortunately, there is no treatment for COVID-19. So I strongly felt that we had to do early diagnosis and early isolation.
Experts believe the number of PCR tests conducted in Japan is extremely low. They hope that the initiative can increase the figure. The machines sell the kits at around $40 each.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.